Today's Taisho will be on Case 51 in the Piyen Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 51 is entitled Seppo's What Is This? Engo's Introduction. If you have the slightest choice of right and wrong, you will fall into confusion of mind. If you are not caught up in the ranks, there is no groping in the dark. Tell me, which is advisable, letting go or holding fast? At this point, if you deal in terms of concepts and remain attached to sophisticated thinking, you are a ghost clinging to weeds and bushes. Even if you become innocent of such vulgarity, you are still thousands of miles away from your homeland. Do you not understand? If not, just study the present koan. See the following. Main subject. When Seppo was living in his hermitage, two monks came to pay respects. As Seppo saw them coming, he pushed open the gate and, presenting himself before them, said, "What is this?" The monks also said, "What is this?" Seppo lowered his head and returned to his cottage. Later, the monks came to Ganto, who said, "Where are you from?" The monks answered, "We had come from south of the Nanrei Mountains." Ganto said, "Have you ever been to see Seppo?" The monks said, "Yes, we have been to him." Ganto said, "What did he say to you?" The monks related the whole story. Ganto said, "Alas, I regret that I did not tell him the last word when I was with him. If I had done so, no one in the whole world could have pretended to outdo him." At the end of the summer session, the monks repeated the story and asked Ganto for his instruction. Ganto said, "Why didn't you ask earlier?" The monks said, "We have had a hard time struggling with this topic." Ganto said, "Seppo came to life in the same way that I did, but he does not die in the same way that I do. If you want to know the last word, I'll simply tell you, this. Secho's verse, "The last word let me tell you, light and darkness intermingled, living in the same way, you all know, dying in different ways, beyond telling. Absolutely beyond telling. Buddha and Dharma only nod to themselves. East, west, north, south. Homeward let us go. Late at night, seeing the snow on the thousand peaks." I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen. When people are ordained, when they take vows and become a priest in the Zen tradition, one of the questions people ask them is, "Are you a human being?" Because according to the Buddhist teachings, only human beings can be ordained. And so far, everybody in our tradition who has been ordained has said yes. So only humans. And humans are really strange creatures, actually. You know, very strange creatures. I remember years ago hiking in the northern part of Washington State, and at some point I stopped to sit down and get a drink of water. And the person I was hiking with suddenly said, "You know what? We're in Canada." And I said, it doesn't feel any different to me. But, you know, big difference, right? Canada and the United States. People in the United States take a lot of pride in being Americans. And people in Canada take a lot of pride in not being Americans. And also being Canadians. And I had a similar experience in El Paso once, you know, wondering if I was in Mexico or if I was in the United States. You know, I got confused. I suppose now, that was 30 years ago, now there's probably a big wall between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. But at that time, it was possible to take a back street and wind up in Juarez instead of El Paso. You know, we take these boundaries for real, you know, really, really real. But they're entirely imaginary constructions, really. I remember reading in a book it was a book about Europe, and it was talking about the fact that for about 300 years, little French boys grew up playing with army soldiers, little toy soldiers, and their soldiers were all wearing the uniform of the French army, and the bad guys were always German soldiers in uniforms of the German army. And they said that little French boys grew up dreaming of conquering and humiliating Germany. And that little German boys played the same game on their side of the line. And that basically, at various times, violence would erupt and thousands of people would die. You might know a little bit about World War I, where they were fighting, there was fighting between the Germans and the French in trenches. And different groups of people would fight, would just shoot out of the trench. They dug a deep, deep trench, and the trenches had little rooms in them and were quite elaborate. And there was a French trench, and there was a German trench. And basically they would come out and shoot each other and occasionally try to take over the other group's trench. And by this time, people had automatic weapons. They had machine guns and so on, and barbed wire. And so when people would try to take a few hundred yards of territory, it would cost thousands and thousands of people just for like a few few hundred yards, maybe even a few dozen yards of territory. And you know, this is could seem so real to us, right? All of this makes perfect sense. Right now we're in Afghanistan, which is thousands of miles from here, you know, and we're fighting a war. Not much has really changed. You know, we live in a world of abstractions which we mistake for real. And this is like this is the glory of human beings, right? I mean, this is our glory, that we can imagine, we can create these things that don't exist at all and treat them as though we're real. And I think this is a game we learn to play as little children, you know. You learn to pick up a stick on the ground and somebody says, "What's that?" And you say, "It's a sword," you know. And the other little kid says, "Okay, I'll play along. It's a sword." I remember when we were growing up on the base, I remember we were walking one day and we discovered a big hole in the ground. Probably somebody had been involved in some kind of construction project that had been unfinished. And in the middle of this field, there was a hole in the ground. And of course, we looked at the hole and we immediately thought, oh, it's a fort, right? It's a fort. So that became our fort. And it's just a hole in the ground. But humans have this capacity to create a kind of imaginary world, and it often involves getting other people to believe it too, right? There's a kind of social dimension to this. We pass these things down over time, you know. So, you know, it's probably the case that, you know, there's really no substantial difference between Americans and Canadians. You know, if there's any Canadians here, Anaï isn't here today, but she might object if she were here. But actually, you know, Canadians and Americans aren't that different. You know, they're very, very, very similar. And the differences between us are largely symbolic, you know, and abstract. It's true, they're members of the British Commonwealth. We aren't. You know, we have the Constitution, they don't. You know. But really, fundamentally, these distinctions between, say, Canadian and American are imaginary distinctions. And humans live in a world of imaginary distinctions that we create collectively and individually, and it makes us human, it binds us together, but often it creates incredible destruction and great unhappiness. When I was working on my book, you know, I talked to Jackie. I showed Jackie the manuscript and asked her if she thought it could get published. And she said, maybe, you know, let's work on it. And we worked on it some more. And then finally, she agreed to try to circulate the manuscript and look for a publisher. And we finally did get a publisher. And I was having tea with Jackie, and Jackie said that writers are some of the most unhappy people in the world. Because, first of all, you write a manuscript, and then you're desperately uncertain about whether it will ever get into print. And you agonize over that, and you agonize, and you lose sleep. And then finally, you find a book agent who says, "Yes, I'll try to place your book with a publisher." So then you stop losing sleep, and you're happy for a few days, right? And you think all is right with the world, right? But then you start worrying. Well, which publisher? And you know, actually, not all publishers are created equal. There's big publishers, and there's little publishers, and there's high class publishers and low class publishers. So basically, after a few days of happiness, the writer starts to become depressed again because of maybe not finding the right press. So at first the fear is maybe just not finding a press, right? So you're worried about not finding a press, but then you begin to think, well, what if it's not the right press? So finally, your book agent lands a press that will accept your book, but you could still be depressed because it's not Harper One. See, not Harper. Harper Collins, let's say. So then you're depressed again. And then you work on the book with the editor, and the editor tells you to rewrite this and rewrite that and rewrite, and you get depressed again. And then the book comes out, and of course, long before this, you were just worried about finding a publisher. But now you have a publisher, the book is in print, it's coming out, but now you worry about the sales figures, right? And if they're not at a certain level, your book is a complete disaster. See, that's your thinking. So this is so human, right? So human. You know, someday an archaeologist, if they have archaeologists, will be working in this area. And they'll come to, they'll drive into, they'll probably come by a boat, right? And they'll come into the boat, into what is now New York City in a boat, and it will all be underwater, you know. And they'll see the Statue of Liberty's head peeking out over the waves. And they'll come to this high-rise building, and they'll say, "Oh, this was the library. Maybe the top of the New York Public Library will be above the water, you know." So the archaeologists will put on their goggles and flippers and everything, and they'll swim down into the New York Public Library, and there'll be all of these fish in there, and jellyfish and so on, and on the shelves you will see the spines of books, and when you go to take the spines, when you go to take the book out of the shelf, of course, it'll just be like a paste, right? It'll dissolve in your hand. I'm in an English department. I'm a teacher of English, and we really and truly believe that the writers we study are immortal. Right? But actually, someday it's going to happen. If humans live long enough on this planet, the day will come when somebody goes, "Have you ever heard of Shakespeare?" And they'll go, "Never heard of him." Right? People go, "Shakespeare, never heard of him." That'll happen, really. Basically, if we live long enough, Shakespeare will be a distant memory. You know, and in fact, you know, I've talked about this before, but lately, Stephen Hawking, the great physicist, has been making statements for the press that have gotten weirder and weirder. I don't know if you followed this. He recently said that we should be very careful about sending things out into space, because he said if invaders come, they'll wipe us out, you know, space invaders. And he really is afraid of that. He said, you know, it'll just be like a disaster. It's very likely they'll attack us and things like that. So we should keep a low profile. But about 10 years ago, even, this is his latest, he's been making statements like this a lot lately, but he's been talking about time machines too. But lately, about 10 years ago, rather, he got very worried about the fact that the sun was going to expand in several billion years. And he actually wrote an article in which he talked about what we're going to have to do in order to escape from the expanding sun in 2 billion years. And you realize the absurdity. He's a brilliant man, you know, but you realize the absurdity of this. You know, humans, no species on Earth has remained unchanged for 2 billion years. In fact, no species has lasted for 2 billion years. In fact, nothing we have made, there's nothing we know in our world right now that will be around in 2 billion years except the world itself. You know, even structures made out of stone, even mountains won't look the same. You know, So, humans live in a symbolic world, and we create distinctions between French and German, American and Canadian, and we believe that the world we've created is absolutely real and permanent. And none of these things are true. None of them are true. You know, humans make themselves happy sometimes by creating these fictions, these incredible fictions. You know, the person who invented the automobile, you know, must have been thinking, this is going to transform humanity forever. But you know, someday we'll probably all be on bicycles again. You know, what I'm getting at is that a lot of the things we do are like a game, You know, we're like little children playing a game, and it's serious play, right? Because we the older we get, the more we believe in it, And education is a way of making us believe in things, right? So I remember reading a poem when I was in high school called "The Second Coming" by William Butler Yeats. And basically, Yeats says it's a poem that where Yeats says everything is falling apart. The center will no longer holds, and we're very disoriented in the modern world. And he said, and now something is coming from the future, which is going to be very destructive, and we don't know what it is. And he says it's a rough beast, He says, some rough beast is slouching toward Bethlehem, waiting to be born. So he says, basically, a monster is going to go to Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, and be born, and we're entering a monstrous new age. Well, as a school child, you know, as a high school kid, actually, and I read this poem, and I thought, huh, what could that mean? And then I went out and shot basketballs, you know. As a college student, I read this poem, and I thought, oh, this is very deep. And I used to lose sleep over this poem. And I remember running into a graduate student who had just gone through a long discussion of Yeats's poem, and she said, don't you see? The center no longer holds, you know. There's a rough beast. And I said, you know, Virginia, it's a poem, right? But she was really worried about it. So many things that we, I think growing up, we learn how to pretend that this world of culture is real. And it can be wonderful in the case of something like the arts, you know. Yeats's poem was asking us to imagine the future in a certain way, to play along with him. And even though we think things like the stock market are real, they're not real either, as we see once in a while. The other day, the stock market plunged, 1,000 points? 700, 800 points in a matter of hours, and nobody knows why. They think it might have been a computer glitch. Now, that's insane, right? I mean, the market lost a huge amount of value because somebody hit a key wrong or there was something wrong with the computer. When that kind of thing happens, everybody realizes, wait a minute, this is not real, it's pretend, right? But all the same, you know, mostly we think it's real. And this happens in other ways too. You know, right now I'm involved with placing graduate students in my department, trying to get them jobs. And there was one graduate student who is not very mature, I would say, and he was very disappointed in getting a job. Because it wasn't at the kind of, he wasn't at the top level institution. See. And meanwhile, other graduate students who are just as smart as he is couldn't find any job at all. They would have, you know, it's the same thing as getting published, right? First you think, I need a job. Oh my God, I need a job. And then you get a job and you think, well, this isn't a good enough job. Right? And then you get depressed because you didn't get the right kind of job and so on and so on. All of this is like very human. And it can make us incredibly unhappy. At its best, this ability to pretend can produce amazing things, right? We all get together and pretend there's something called the economy, you know? And we buy and sell products, and we also buy and sell, we also place bets on what we'll buy and sell in the future, and we'll sell the bets, and so on and so on. We do that, you know, and we'll bet against the market. You know, these are all like games we play. Sometimes they produce great wealth that produces human happiness. But all of this is really like, at the ground level, all of this is fantasy. It's a kind of collective fantasy. And often we make ourselves quite unhappy, like this graduate student who got a job which should have made him happy, but then became very depressed because it wasn't a top flight university, see, which made him very unhappy. This guy's like a prisoner of his of our collective fantasies, right? A prisoner of collective fantasies. One of my favorite books used to be War and Peace, which I must confess I've only read once. But it's pretty long, it's famously long, and I read it a little bit every week until I finished it. But it's left a lasting impression on me. And one of the lead character is a illegitimate son of the richest man in Russia. And when his father dies, he inherits this massive fortune. And he's utterly unhappy. And when Napoleon invades Russia, The main character is forced to flee for his life with a peasant. And our main character, our hero, has had every luxury in life. You know, he's been very wealthy and powerful, and now he's fleeing for his life as French soldiers, and it's just chaos, and everything is falling apart. And he's sleeping with his peasant in barns, like on those hay in barns. And he realizes this peasant is really a wise person. You know, the peasant just says, you know, if I get up in the morning and I have something to eat, I'm ecstatic. I'm ecstatic. You know, and he said, the hero begins to realize this guy has such a simple life, and he's so happy just being in the moment. You know, Tolstoy wasn't a Buddhist, but he really understood that we create these artificial distinctions that make us very unhappy and make life seem like a terrible experience. But actually, you know, being in the moment, you know, just simply present with things as they are can be incredibly transformative and liberating. And so basically, this is this part of the book where the prince is living with this peasant is really deeply transformative. He realizes that so much of what he's believed in, you know, the social scene in Moscow and the pecking order and who's worth this amount of money and who's worth that amount of money. All of this is just like such a dream, like a collective dream. And for the first time in his life, he cuts through it, you know. And this is very much what meditation is about, you know. It's like we need these structures. We need these artificial structures to organize ourselves. You've got to organize yourself somehow, right? I mean, we're social beings. But when we take the structures too seriously, we make ourselves very unhappy, you know, very unhappy. And there's a way to live, there's a way to live without being so dependent on these structures. You know, this morning when I woke up, outside my window, there were some crows calling. The crows in my neighborhood have really come back in large numbers. And yesterday too, when I got up and when I was meditating yesterday morning, the crows were calling. And this morning as I was getting ready to come here to sit, I was listening to the crows and I thought, you know, in some societies, hearing a crow is considered like really bad luck. You know, it's like an ominous, it's like an omen of doom, you know. Hearing a crow, it's like a bad sign. And in some cultures, you know, actually crows and ravens are considered like symbols of death. So you could be listening to a crow and you could think, oh my God, death, death. See, death is coming to my door. And there's a wonderful folk song called There's a Crow on the Cradle. It's about losing a little baby. And there's a crow on the cradle. See, the death comes to the crow sitting on the cradle. But you know, there are other cultures in the world where a crow is like very good luck. Like Native Americans liked ravens. They actually thought raven was like a messenger. Like the Garuda in Indian thinking, the raven flies up to heaven and then it flies back to earth. So it goes between the realm of the spirits and the realm of the human being. So for the Native Americans, a raven was like a wise bird, see? So for people in the West, like in Europe, ravens are symbols of death. And for Native Americans, ravens are symbols of wisdom and transcendence, you know? So which is it? Well, neither, right? Neither. And it's very hard to encounter the world as it actually is, you know, cutting through all the baloney. Now, you know, there's something really cool about our poetic imagination, our ability to say to the raven, you see a raven and you think, ah, messenger from heaven. See, ah, he's descended from the heights and he's bringing us a message. What is it? What do the spirits have to tell us? Ah, ah. See, you think, what could that mean? You know, what could it mean? Or, you know, if you're in Europe, you know, you might have a raven come and he goes, oh, oh, and you think, oh my God, who's going to die? See, this is so human. And we think, you know, we think, oh, I understand, I understand. But immediately we go back into the collective dream. But immediately. You know, I understand. It's symbolic. But there are some things that aren't symbolic, like the economy. No, you know, actually the economy is symbolic. Have you ever thought about money? Like a dollar bill? It's worth like what? 3 cents? You know, in terms of materials. What does it represent? And it used to represent a bunch of gold in Fort Knox, but it doesn't anymore. It represents relationships to other money, basically. Maybe that's one way to talk about it. It's really not even a certain number of commodities anymore. It's like it's a relationship to other currencies, really, you know. I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about, but, you know, assume that I do. For the sake of argument, I'm just trying to say that it's not real either. Right? And in my field, you know, what's called literary reputation is not real. So, you know, one of the things, if you have nothing else to do in your life and you're an English graduate student, one of the things you could waste an afternoon doing is looking up old book reviews. And you can read reviewers saying, this writer is surely going to be among the greatest writers of our time, right? And so often it's a guy you've never heard of, right? Somebody sat in his office and read this book and said, surely this guy is utterly immortal. And now you say, Hergesheimer? Who's he? Right? Hergesheimer? Never heard of him. See, I mean, I personally feel it's a shame that we can't live in our cultural world more loosely. You know, we can't take it less seriously. You know, you're not supposed to take it lightly. You're not supposed to. All the pressure is take it seriously. You know, one of the reasons people spend billions of dollars on advertising is because they want you to take it seriously. You know, so that you actually worry about the cut of your pants or something like that. You know, you actually worry, oh my God, strapless gowns, they're so out this season, right? I went to the party and I suddenly realized, my God, you know, it's now, I was looking on Huffington Post yesterday and I see that crisscross straps are now the thing. Straight straps are out. So you could go to a party and somebody could say, oh my God, you're wearing straight straps. Where have you been? Have you been asleep for 1,000 years? You know. See, I mean, I think that's an unhappy way to live. There's a wonderful story in Chinese literature. It's actually like in Chinese folk culture. This guy's going up in the mountains, right? And he's up in the mountains. Maybe he's hunting. And he finds a cave, and he goes into the cave. And he goes into this cave deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, and then he sees light at the end of the tunnel, and he goes out, and he's in a valley. And it's full of people. And they're happy, they have their farms, they're growing fruit trees, there's fish in the pond. And when he comes up to the people, they say, hi, how are you? And he said, good, I just came through this cave. And they say, what dynasty is it anyway? See, in other words, you know, empires come and go. You know, dynasties come and go. You know, it doesn't really matter that much. Just be in the moment. You know, now this sounds very, might sound very abstract, but Zen is all about, you know, like cutting through the dream and getting back to like things as they actually are, as they actually are. There is no Canada. No, there is no Canada. There is no United States. United States is a collective dream. It's a dream. And it's very sad when people, you know, take these things too seriously. It causes a lot of unhappiness. So Zen is all about learning how to be like, live in culture without being caught up by culture, without being trapped by culture. You know, when you're doing your Zazen, the ideal way to sit is like this. And in front of your eyes is what you see, you know, but behind your eyes is what's going on the screen in your head, you know. There's like two realms, so to speak. There's the world of form that you perceive in front of you, yeah. But while you're looking at that, it's like behind your eyes, in your head, so to speak, there's like another screen, and there's all this stuff going on the screen. When you do meditation and you sit down on the cushion, you become aware of what's on the other screen, right? So when you sit down and you close your eyes and you start trying to watch your breath, all of a sudden you realize that there's all this stuff going on in your head. There's movies playing, you're reliving events. You're thinking through things. If you have had an emotionally difficult experience, you're reliving that experience again and again and again, and it's triggering the same emotions over and over again. So this is all going on sort of like, as I say, behind your eyes, and usually we don't pay attention. You know, so let's say you're married, and you have kids, and your kid has gotten into trouble, and you've tried to handle the situation, and you haven't handled it well. You know, so maybe the kid is doing something at school that's not right, and you try to talk to the kid, and maybe your child's a teenager, and he or she explodes in anger, and then you explode in anger. Okay, now you have to go to work. And when you walk through the door of your office, you know, you're still fighting with your son or your daughter, right? And you have to sit there and go, focus, focus, you know? And then maybe somebody comes through the door and goes, listen, have you had a chance to work on the report? And you go, no, of course not. You're not mad at that person, right? You're still fighting it out with your son or daughter. This is so human, right? And this goes on, of course, all our lives, you know? Many times we're still struggling with arguments we had with our mothers and fathers when we were little children. You know, we're still fighting it out with our brothers, you know, 30 years later in our heads. We're still frightened of something that happened to us 40 years ago. And so we've been going through life for 40 years preparing for another event like that, you see, or reliving it behind our eyes. And you know, one of the functions of like therapy, which I think is very good for people, is to become more aware of what's playing behind your eyes. But you know, becoming aware of it is not the same thing as being able to let it go, to get free from it. And I think Zen is very valuable because you know, there's an ideal state. There's a state of mind which is like thoughtless awareness. And when we do emptiness meditation, we're really trying to be able to, when you do meditation and you begin to do emptiness meditation and you're sitting there going moo, 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 you know, at some point your mind should become blank behind your eyes, blank and dark. And you should have like nothing going on in your head. And of course, if you've done meditation for a while and you have been practicing Mu, you have had those moments where the screen behind your eyes is blank and empty, or empty and dark, or empty and bright. And then when you open your eyes, you know, everything is so alive and so crisp and clear. It's so beautiful. Because the movie isn't running behind your eyes. You're not reliving the event from 1972 as you're here in 2010. You're just present in the moment, see. And this is really, like, truly, it's not the highest form of enlightenment, but it is enlightenment, right? It's very important to be liberated from these ghosts. See, what does it say in this koan? It says, you are a ghost clinging to weeds and bushes. You know, it can be a perfectly good day, a perfectly good day. And people can sit down and they're just agonized because something happened a month ago, a year ago, 20 years ago, and they're still replaying it in their heads, still replaying it. See, this is like the human disease. The same power that makes it possible for us to, like, imagine skyscrapers and build them makes us unable to be free in the moment, you know? And so Zen practice is really about healing, about liberating ourselves from the ghosts and being present in the moment, which is often just astonishingly beautiful and wonderful. In fact, always, yeah? So, you know, when you're sitting on the cushion and you watch your breath, you're learning how to develop one-pointed awareness. You're learning how to focus your mind like a flashlight on the object of your attention. That's step number one. Step number two is if you focus your mind on the breath long enough, you become one with the breath. This is the unification of subject and object. And this is a non-dualistic awareness. This is step two. See? And then you usually feel bliss when you have that kind of a samadhi experience, that unification with the world. You feel like blissful. Okay. Step three is emptiness meditation. Is that becoming the mind behind the eyes becomes blank and dark, and when you open your eyes, what you see is what's actually present. You're not projecting anything. See, you're not projecting anymore. You're just present. And you're not having, like, conditioned responses to things. See, you're not... Normally, we have, like, these highly conditioned responses to things, right? But sometimes it becomes possible to experience the world just as it is, in its pristine perfection. But it's very difficult for humans to do this. Very, very difficult. But it's still possible. And this is what Zen practice is all about. You know, when the Buddha woke up, when he described enlightened mind, he said it's like looking down into a pond where the water is totally clear. And you can see the fish, you can see the rocks, see? He says everything is just what it is. In absolute, it's lucid presentness. It's tat-atta, is the Buddhist word for that, lucid presentness. But it requires a mind that is like a thoughtless mind. Now, your mind may not be totally thoughtless. A more typical state is there are thoughts, but they're coming and going like clouds in the sky. So it's like your attention is riveted on the breath or on mu. And there are thoughts, but they're not at the center of your attention. They're over to one side, and they're coming and going like clouds blowing across a blue summer sky. So they're not absorbing all your mental energy. They're not absorbing all your attention. This is a more typical state. Like, the totally blank mind is very difficult to achieve. Eventually, you will be able to achieve it and hold it for, like, intervals of, say, an hour. You know, that would be quite an amazing achievement. But certainly you'll be able to do it for a while, you know. But more typically, you're in a state where your mind is rather blank, but a thought comes and then another thought comes, but it doesn't trigger all these responses. You know, in ordinary consciousness, you know, what happens is when thoughts arise, they trigger all these conditioned responses. So if you think of going into the office and you get anxious in the office, when you think about going to the office, you find the anxiety arising, you know. But you know, when you're in the mu, And you remember the office, it doesn't trigger a powerful response. You just think office, right? And then it moves on, and then you're back in the moment, and then another thought comes. But this condition is so precious and so important. It's really the beginning of liberation. And, you know, when people do Zen, they might imagine Zen is all about, like, secret mysteries and, you know, basically miraculous, you know, you might be lifted to another dimension where you see gods and you see magical beings and so on and so on. And this is actually not the solution to our problems. This is actually the problem. See, I mean, we want to go to this realm which is transcendent and which is, you know, utterly wonderful and splendid and so on. But we're already in a place that's utterly wonderful and splendid. The problem is we keep manufacturing these fantasies. We're like, have like a fantasy machine. And it becomes very hard to break out because a whole society says it's real, right? The whole society says it's real. In ancient traditions, in not just the West, but in the East also, people who are highly advanced are not thought to be very concerned about money, you know? In the Tibetan tradition, there was a famous teacher, Milarepa, who was given a bunch of money to teach, and he took the money and set it on fire. You know, this is in a society where money's very hard to come by. People were very poor. In Chinese tradition also, people who were deeply enlightened were not thought to be very interested in things like material wealth. And it's not because they want to suffer poverty. It's just that they knew that this is a game that's not worth playing at some point. Now, I don't think you should quit your job and live under a bridge. You know, I think that would be a mistake. And I don't think people should... I do think economics is valuable because if people can have a decent standard of living and education and so on, life will be better. We need these symbolic systems in order to live. We can't do without them. You know, if you look at any aspect of life, it's like that. You know, there are cultures where one man marries one woman. And in those cultures, some people are happy and some people aren't. In the United States, about half the people who get married get divorced. So one man, one woman, and free choice works okay. In places like India, they have arranged marriages a lot of the time, and even though people might say they're very unhappy, you know, that doesn't work, or that works, it probably works some of the time, and it probably isn't successful some of the time. There are also places where one man has multiple wives, and believe it or not, there's places where one woman can have multiple husbands. Although I can't imagine why any woman would want more than one husband. Because one is enough trouble, right? But the point is, all these variations are possible because it's symbolic, right? It's symbolic. There's no real way to have these relationships. There's no one right way. So we need like a system. We need a game. We need to say, okay, one man marries one woman, or one man marries three women, or one woman marries three men, or something. We need some kind of a game. But you know, I think if we don't wake up from culture is like a collective dream, and if we don't wake up, we probably will destroy ourselves, you know? I really believe that. You know, when you look at something like World War II, where something like 200 million people died in 4 years. For what? For fantasies. For fantasies, right? You realize we've got to wake up from this dream of culture, not just as a society, but like as individuals, because people can be profoundly miserable over things that are totally imaginary. And Zen is really, I think, very important because it really makes you realize, you know, this is like a dream. And when you wake up from the dream and you find yourself in the moment, you realize all of, you know, it's like, have you ever had this, when I get a fever, sometimes I'll get a fever, And I have these like totally crazy dreams if I have the flu, you know. They're like insane. You can't even explain them to people. It's like I'll think, I've got to, the window, you know, open the window. And I wake up and realize, why was I worried about the window, you know? It wasn't even a thought. It was just like this fantasy that I was having. Right? The window, I've got to open the window. Or the package, you know, I've got to get the package out, you know, and you wake up and realize there is no package, you know. Well, I think meditation practice is like that, you know. It's like a normal human reality, it becomes so absorbing, we're like in this collective dream, and we're sort of thrashing around on our beds, worried about something that's not real. And then, you know, meditation practice is like waking up and suddenly going, oh, I'm safe, you know, everything's okay. You know, how nice to be under these covers in the middle of a winter night, you know. And meditation is like that. You suddenly realize, oh my gosh, this world is so precious. Why was I so unhappy? If you have the slightest choice of right and wrong, you will fall into confusion of mind. In other words, right and wrong are games we play. They're not real, you know. If you know, you can eat with chopsticks, you can eat with a fork and a spoon, you can eat with your fingers. We have rules, but you know, actually they're artificial, right? If you have the slightest choice of right and wrong, you will fall into confusion of mind. If you are not caught up in the ranks, there will be no groping in the dark. If you're not too caught up in the collective illusion, tell me, which is advisable, letting go or holding fast? Those two are just arbitrary distinctions. So how do you live in culture and not be trapped by culture? And it's not an abstract question. How do you live in a world which is really quite a wonderful place to be and not create dreams that make it into a kind of hell? Yeah? So monks came to Seppo's hut and they said, and they wanted his wisdom, and he came out and he stood before them and said, what is this? What is present here and now? Seppo lowered his head and went into his cottage. And he said, look for it. Yeah? And when the monks go to Ganto, they said, well, what would you say? And he said, it's already here. It's always already here. So this is like two different approaches, right? You know, but the point is, reality is right here. And when we practice Zen, we're cutting away our illusion. We really are literally breaking through this dream and getting back to this moment as it actually is. And maybe this morning after doing meditation, we walk outside and you hear the wind, you see the play of shadow and light on the ground. And if you were not really fully liberated, and you hear the wind and you see the play of shadow and light, you were thinking, shadow and light, what could that represent, right? But if you're really in deep samadhi and you walk outside and you see shadows and light on the ground, you look at them like you're a baby without an idea in your head. And you're just fully present with the shadow and the light. And that's a deeper state of concentration. That's really a very important achievement, to be able to see things that way. It's an empty mind. Because shadow and light don't mean anything, ultimately. They just are what they are. Being able to appreciate that. And by the way, when you're in that state, everything becomes indescribably precious and vivid. Absolutely, the most ordinary sounds become like a beautiful music. I'm sure you've had a little taste of that. So anyway, let's all just learn how to be a bit stupid. And be present in the moment without thinking too much. And we'll all live longer and be happier, and that would be a wonderful thing.